Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, your weekly information security news and current affairs show. My name's Patrick Gray. In just a minute, Adam Boileau and I will be talking through most of the news we missed while we were on break. We can't get through absolutely everything because there's too much of it, but yeah, there's some good stuff to talk through this week. And then we will be hearing from this week's sponsor, and this week's show is brought to you by Trail of Bits. We'll be hearing from Trail of Bits practice lead for assurance, Stefan Edwards, all about its work on a recent security audit of Kubernetes. And as it turns out, Kubernetes isn't actually a horror show, but Stefan thinks you might want to run a hosted instance unless you're a real expert. That's a really interesting interview, and it is coming up after the news with Adam Boileau, which starts now. And Adam, we have previously spoken about the Turla / oil rig hostile APT takeover. And it turns out that, that the extent of the Russian takeover of an Iranian APT crew was, a little bit more severe than we previously knew.
Yeah, according to reporting, they were up in the command and control infrastructure and had access to all of the kind of software and tooling, were able to build their own versions of some of the tools, and were, just operating straight through the infrastructure of the Iranians, which is pretty funny, to be honest.
Stealing intel gathered by somebody else's APT, campaign, that's one thing, but then just taking over the whole thing, that's nice.
It certainly is, yeah. And why not? Like, what are they going to do about it? Absolutely nothing. If you're trying to muddy the waters for attribution, or you're taking advantage of things that are already in place on targets that you're also interested in, then why not just go the extra step and help yourself to all their infrastructure and all their tooling. Seems like a good plan, and hey, if it works, right, that's all that matters.
Yeah, I saw an incident responder / threat intel person on Twitter sort of saying, if you allow SSH, if you're SSH wrapping like reverse shells with creds to your C2, this is the kind of thing that happens. And I figure they're kind of subtweeting that APT crew and calling them trash, which is funny.
Well, these guys aren't necessarily amazing hackers, right? You're like running your operation with really tight OPSEC and doing it all really well. Like, that is actually genuinely hard. And you've got stuff to get done, and you've got to get on with your life. You've got to hand it over between different crews. It's kind of complicated to run a nation state hacking team and to do so, in a way that isn't trash.
Yeah.
It makes sense the Russians would, take advantage of that. And of course, then there's the attribution benefits from this, even after this kind of activity has been discussed publicly like it is now, even then the Iranians go, well, maybe the Russians did it, and it just muddies everything.
Well, what sort of country likes to confuse people like that, Adam?
Well, exactly, right? Exactly.
If it's really confusing, it's usually Russia, right?
Although maybe it's the Israelis hacking the Russians to hack the Iranians.
You never know. But look, I think it's important that we don't throw the baby out with the bathwater, because in this case, we have been able to determine that there was some false flagging go on and kind of pin down the real actor, right? So I think a few people have been going a little bit overboard saying, see, attribution is impossible, and sort of going down, going back to that whole thing. But I do think we're going to see more of this sort of stuff, right?
Yeah, well, it makes sense, right? I mean, A, it gets where you need to be in terms of access to the information or whatever your goals are. B, it makes it complicated, blame somebody else. And C, it's easy, right? It works. Why wouldn't you do it?
Now, look, staying with Turla, we got a great piece here from ZDNet about an interesting little technique that the Russians have come up with.
Yeah, this is a really fascinating story. The Russians have been deploying a piece of, kind of post-intrusion malware that modifies the TLS libraries used by browsers like Firefox and Chrome to add like a fingerprint to the initial TLS negotiation process that then you can observe from the outside, and is also kind of cryptographically related to the identity of the machine. So they know when they look at a TLS stream on the network somewhere else that it came from a machine that they had previously dropped this malware on, and they can tell which particular one. Which is a really interesting technique, and obviously a thing that you're using as part of a much larger, process, and we're not really sure what that larger process is.
Well, yeah, I was going to wonder, if you're in a position to start messing with people's, the code on people's machines that is negotiating TLS connections, what else do you need to do at that point, right? I would have thought you've already won.
That is a good question, right? I mean, they're in a position to be able to read network traffic before it gets TLS. Obviously, they can screen scrape and key log and read the data and stuff. So yeah, they don't need it then. But I mean, I guess there must be some reason why you would do this. I mean, for example, if you're just trying to figure out who's using anonymity networks, maybe, or where things come out of the network, or you're trying to correlate activity that you know, you have a bunch of suspicion about this group of users is doing something, and maybe, you know, maybe it's like going after whistleblowers or leakers or something like that, like where you would deploy it on a big pool of machines to try and figure out which one is doing a thing that's coming out the other side of Tor, for example, and you don't know which one it is. So I mean, there may be some reasons why, but clearly it's just a, you know, it's a really interesting...
It's an interesting thing to observe, isn't it? Like, yeah, it's exactly. An interesting thing to pop up in the wild.
Yeah, and it's a thing that you would be doing for, you know, some quite specific reason, and we just don't know what it is, and that's the kind of interesting and curious part.
Yeah. Now, when China wants to build an aerospace industry, a whole lot of people are going to get a whole lot of owned, and this next report, I mean, wow, what do you even say?
Yeah, I mean, this is going through the work that China's been doing over many years to break into all of the aerospace companies in the West and around the world to help themselves to intellectual property, to assist with building up their own domestic, in this case, kind of commercial aircraft industry. And you know, it kind of goes through some of the intrusions that we've seen and the kind of organizational structure and the way they, you know, kind of hand off the individual targets to subcontractors and, you know, people involved in the kind of hacker scene in China that are then, you know, working for the government, because I imagine you don't have much choice about working for the government there. And yeah, the targets are everyone you would expect. I mean, you know, Airbus and all the manufacturers of, you know, Honeywell and all those sorts of people who manufacture equipment and, you know, airframe parts and, you know, turbofans and all those sorts of things that go into aircraft. And yeah, everybody just getting a whole bunch of own for, you know, years and years and years.
Yeah, and in this case, CrowdStrike has, you know, published a report that looks at China's Comac C919 airplane and says, like, oh, this bit came from this contractor, this bit came from that contractor. It's like, you know, this is a plane built by hackers.
Yeah, and I mean, it also looks into the, you know, in some cases they've achieved their goals through the kind of, you know, joint venture approach that then results in, you know, kind of technology transfer, is that the euphemism? And in some cases it's done through hacking, in some cases it's done through, you know, Chinese nationals working for these companies then being pressured to go plug a USB stick in to gain entrance that way when they haven't done it through the usual sorts of, you know, remote hacking techniques. So, you know, really sort of a blended approach to, you know, large scale, you know, international industrial espionage.
Yeah, and we did see that recent reporting too about Airbus having some issues and the primes generally having some issues because their, you know, secondary contractors are getting owned and their access into the primes' networks is being leveraged to do, you know, it's a bad time to be defending the networks of companies like Airbus and Boeing, let's put it that way.
Yeah, I mean, it really is, because these are huge networks filled with juicy stuff, loads of weird commercial relationships and technical relationships and lots of stuff. It's just really, really hard to defend this kind of environment and against an attacker that is, you know, properly motivated.
Yeah, and in the end, you know, I mean, this means China's probably going to start making some pretty good planes.
Yeah, well, yeah, right.
Because they've picked best of breed from everywhere, right? Yeah. There you go. Now, a while ago, we spoke about Imperva getting owned. And I got to say, they get a big biscuit from us this week because they wrote a really detailed incident post-mortem and published it to their website and, you know, did a really solid investigation. And it looks like, you know, it probably wasn't the end of the world, this breach. They did get properly owned, but it looks like whoever did the hacking didn't really do much with it. That's the general sense I got from reading their post. Was that also your takeaway?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good write-up, and it's nice to see people being open about how these things happened. I mean, obviously, I'm always a little skeptical of people who say, well, you know, this is the thing that the hackers did with the data, because you don't really know, you're just kind of making it up. But yeah, I mean, it didn't look, you know, it's quite as super bad as it could be, but I mean, I'm sure the customers who had all of their TLS keys nicked and API keys nicked didn't really feel that way. The write-up says that they had at some point been testing Amazon's RDS, you know, database in the cloud service and had uploaded a copy of their customer database with all the keys and things into that to test it. At some point, they then later on lost an AWS API key that had been lying around somewhere on an internal machine or a VM somewhere. And then that was subsequently what was used to access this instance of the copy of the data set from a particular point in time, which is why when we originally reported, we said that only customers who had signed up before a certain date were affected. That was because that was when the copy of the database was made. So anyway, it's really nice to see, you know, a good write-up that describes exactly what happened and the process that they went through to triage that, because so many places you don't don't have a lot of confidence that they have triaged it properly. In this case, at least you've got that. But, you know, what that actually means for those customers, we still don't, I mean, we don't really know.
Yeah, yeah, that is true. Zendesk, meanwhile, has disclosed a 2016 data breach affecting something like 10,000 users.
Yeah, so Zendesk provides kind of like customer service interaction sorts of services. And so when they say 1,000 customers, they mean like 1,000 organizations that use their service for however many.
10,000, I think you mean. 10,000.
Sorry, 10,000, yes. 10,000 customers. So, and those customers are obviously other organizations. So we don't, you know, it's potentially quite a big group. But I mean, we, you know, we've seen Zendesk used for so many things as a kind of a, you know, ticketing and interaction management and all sorts of data ends up in those kinds of tickets and messaging systems. So, you know, the downstream impact of compromise of these things, you know, really varies between individual, you know, organizations that are using it. Zendesk have been owned a couple of times in the past, I think, as well. But, yeah, I mean, just goes to show, right? I mean, all these kind of quite complicated as-a-service apps that do one particular thing are great targets because they collect information about their end customers in ways that aren't necessarily obvious. So they make really good targets.
Yeah, I mean, the stuff that was stolen included email addresses, names, and phone numbers of agents and end users of certain Zendesk products up to November 2016. Agent and end user passwords that were hashed and salted potentially up to November 2016. Here's the interesting stuff. TLS encryption keys provided to Zendesk by customers. And I'm guessing that's for embedded agents or something on websites, but like, yikes. Configuration settings of apps installed from the Zendesk app marketplace or private apps. This may include integration keys used by those apps to authenticate against third-party services. So yeah, that's not great. We got a German manufacturer who has been shut down by the BitPayma ransomware since October 13, and they're having a bad time, apparently.
Yeah, this is the company Pills. They make a kind of automation equipment. Yeah, apparently they are entirely dead in the water thanks to ransomware, you know, are in the process of trying to, you know, rebuild all of their stuff from scratch, as, you know, many of the organizations that have been ransomwared are trying to deal with. So yeah, that's you know, yet another other big company being taken out by, you know, I guess at least it's a different set of ransomware than usual.
Earlier this week, I actually interviewed Eric Rosenbach, who's the co-director of the Belfer Center, Harvard, you know, was formerly the chief of staff at the Pentagon. And yeah, he had some interesting stuff to say on this as well, because, you know, this has become an ongoing discussion on the show, which is, you know, are these actions by non-state affiliated criminals, you know, national security relevant? And he definitely says yes. I'm recording a second interview. The main focus of that interview is on ICS security, and I'm recording a second part of that podcast with Robert Lee of Dragos in a couple of days, and I'll be packaging all of that up and putting it live next week. That's one of the Hewlett podcasts that they've commissioned. It's interesting stuff, right? So I'm just mentioning it now to suggest that listeners don't miss that one. NordVPN got owned, and their marketing is like particularly horrible, but all of the VPN companies do this horrible marketing saying, oh, you know, protect yourself against hackers, against state surveillance, against everything by using our VPN. That's not the way the world works. I mean, most of the reason that people would use a VPN in somewhere like, you know, a country like Australia is to get around the blocking of like torrent websites and stuff. Like that's been a big driver. Like when the government started allowing, you know, rights holders to demand ISPs block those sites, the VPN companies made off like bandits. But yeah, NordVPN got owned, and there's a surprising amount of arm flapping around this on the old internets.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of it, as you alluded to, is because of their marketing, right? They're very big in promoting themselves on, you know, on YouTube and social media and amongst influencers, you know, people who have no business making, you know, offering internet security advice to people, you know, shilling NordVPN. So it's a name that people are familiar with. And they've always been kind of, you know, oh, you can't hack us, we're amazing, we'll secure all your stuff, when, you know, clearly not the case. And what happened in here is that they got at least one or more of their boxes co-located in some data center in Finland. Owned. It sounds like the co-location provider they were buying off had left the lights out management system for their servers, like lying on the internet, presumably with either default creds or one of the common bugs, got owned. And of course, the private keys for the like star.nordvpn.com certificates were on there, which is not a great thing because now you could man in the middle ongoing VPS, you know, connections to the VPN service. They did say that the way their network's kind of architected, getting access to one of the VPN bounces doesn't necessarily get you everything other than potentially in the middle of the traffic traversing that one kind of node in Finland. But obviously from a marketing point of view, it's really not a good look to have your private keys, you know, kicking around on Pastebin, which is, you know, kind of what happened. So
yeah, I could think of, that's the ultimate insult, isn't it, really?
Pretty much.
Avast got owned again. Now, Avast, of course, you know, CCleaner is an Avast joint. And did this one have anything to do with CCleaner? Was this to do with supply chain infiltration again or motives unclear? I didn't get a chance to read this one.
Yeah, so what happened here is it sounds like they had some remote access, single factor remote access to their network, that they had left lying around. They made it sound like it was a test account or something that they'd forgotten about. Anyway, presumably someone welcome-oned their way in, and then, yeah, it did seem that whoever was in there was interested in going after CCleaner and supply chain sort of stuff. They've been a bit vague about what it means and whether it was, you know, like how much is related to the previous intrusions into their, you know, using them for supply chain attacks. But either way, it's just really, really not good. And according to the write-up, they detected, and it sounds like they're running Microsoft ATP, they detected a malicious replication of directory services from an internal IP, which is to say someone just desynced your domain, DC-synced your domain controller's creds, and you're never going to evict them ever, regardless of what you're saying. You're going to have a really, really bad time. So they got really very, very owned,
yes.
Which, you know, it's just not really that good for a security vendor.
No, it's not. Law enforcement had a bit of a win while we were on break. This website, so-called dark web website, Welcome to Video, which was apparently a massive child exploitation video sharing website, that one's been brought down. And, you know, a lot of the reporting says that this initially was an IRS investigation that traced Bitcoin, that was looking into Bitcoin and sort of traced it back, and that's how it happened. But it turns out, too, OPSEC wasn't really their forte, Adam, because if you viewed the HTML source of, like, the login page, there were a couple of its real-world IPs in there, which usually when you're operating a giant criminal enterprise is not something you want to do.
No, not so much. The guy who was running is a 23-year-old South Korean man. Apparently not very good at OPSEC. There was a bunch of places where they were leaking IP addresses of the actual real site behind Tor. It was running like out of his house. There was a bunch of stuff that was just kind of registered in his own name. So yeah, it wasn't really a, you know, super sophisticated operation in terms of the OPSEC. I mean, obviously it was quite significant in terms of the scale of its other operation. But yeah, it's good to see a site like that taken down. We've seen this story kind of be a little bit hijacked by some of the, oh, well, this just goes to show that law enforcement don't have to worry about things going dark because you can still find things, you know, through other means like this, which on one hand is true. On the other hand, like, this is clearly really garbage. But on the other hand, I mean, the amount of time it's taken for this to go away, I mean, this investigation has been going on a couple of years. There's been arrests, you know, all around the world.
But I find it funny that it's like, yeah, it was the IRS, you know, tracing Bitcoin, probably using highly specialized, expensive software when they could have just right-click their way to victory on this, you know, like,
dear.
You do wonder if they
although, I mean, it did appear that a bunch of people had noticed that, because Zach Whitaker from TechCrunch wrote up a really interesting story about his experience with this, where someone actually contacted him a couple of years ago saying, hey, we've identified, you know, some IP addresses associated with the site. We've hacked into it. We've got a bunch of stuff. And then, of course, he was unable to kind of really report about it at the time. I think he was working for, was it ZDNet at the time?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, and that was unable to kind of report on it because of a bunch of, kind of issues of interacting with child exploitation sites. But anyway, it's just a really interesting write-up of his experience of being on the side of a story that, you know, he couldn't report because, you know, it was reasonable to assume that it was under investigation at the time. And if he'd reported, he might have blown that investigation and he couldn't publish. And then, of course, his source got upset and kind of rage quit and doesn't want to talk to him anymore. And he's just kind of stuck in the middle, not being able to get any closure. And not even, I think he eventually talks about that he reported it to the FBI, convey the technical information that they got, but then of course gets nothing because he doesn't get told about the investigation. And kind of that experience, I just thought was an interesting thing to read about, you know, what it's like being a journalist handling this sort of stuff.
I got to say, it feels a little familiar, you know, like shades of that, you know, pop up all the time in that sort of job. So Now here's a headline for you. Hacking 20 high-profile developer accounts could compromise half of the NPM ecosystem. And, you know, you just read that. It's a big claim. And then immediately you sort of sanity check it and go, yeah, sounds about right.
Yeah, sounds legit to me. This was the result of some research out of the University of Darmstadt in Germany, where they built a graph showing the relationship between all of the software packages in the NPM, main NPM repository. So they pulled them all down, they analyzed the metadata, they figured out what depended on what and who maintained what, and eventually I built a graph that showed the relationship between all of the packages, you know, in the garbage supply chain of NPM, and then figured out who has the most influence in that environment and who you would need to compromise to, you know, be able to Trojan 50% of the packages at once or something, which ends up being, you know, 20-odd people, which... Yeah, I mean, it's really good research, and it's exactly the sort of thing that a hacker is going to do, right? I mean, we know how to think about, you know, attacking supply chains and picking the important places to go. So, yeah, it's good to see this kind of research done and, you know, kind of make people perhaps think a little bit more about why the sort of micro-packagey sort of approach to software distribution just kind of makes your supply chain problems that much worse.
Mm. Now, this next story kind of underscores some of the problems with using so-called cyber attacks.
Cybers.
In a military context, because we've seen a round of reporting from Reuters saying that the United States launched a so-called secret cyber operation against Iran in September after that missile attack on Saudi Aramco. Iran has denied it and said, oh, you know, the Americans must have dreamt that it happened, which is some nice shade there. Not really many details. And it's like, you know, it looks like Iran's just kind of shrugging this one off. So, you know, whether or not it actually inflicted harm upon them, we don't really know, right? And that's kind of one of the issues is, you know, we sort of spoke about that a while ago, where you got this situation where countries can sort of deny that these attacks have taken place. And that sort of mutes some of the effect. But we don't really know what's happened here.
Well, that's the thing, right? We're meant to be signaling to show international relations, and we don't know what's being signaled or what's happened, and that makes it difficult to judge from the outside. And maybe the Iranians got given a clear message, you know, by whatever happened, and we just aren't seeing it yet, and maybe we will eventually. Or maybe they didn't do anything. Maybe they're just saying, hey, we did a really big cyber to you, and you didn't spot it, lol, right? And now the Iranians are running around spending all their time doing incident response, you know, probably having to, you know, go own FireEye to steal some incident response tools or something. And, yeah, no one knows what's going on. I mean, who knows which, you know, how many levels of you know, sneaky we are deep now. It's just, it's all the way down. Who knows? Turtles. But, yeah, it's just very confusing as an observer trying to make sense of this crazy cyber world we live in, which is what you and I are stuck doing. We don't know what happened. Who knows? Maybe they RM'd lots of stuff. Maybe they didn't.
Now, at this moment, Adam, I think we should stop and just have a moment of sympathy for the people preparing the prosecution brief for Paige Thompson. Now, obviously, Paige Thompson is, you know, in a pretty tight spot herself, and, you know, we certainly have some sympathy for her. But I also have sympathy for the prosecutors in this case who are currently going through between 20 and 30 terabytes of stolen data as a part of preparing the brief here. My God, can you imagine being responsible for combing through all of that?
Yeah, that's a long time to spend sitting around an Encase or whatever trying to make sense of that amount of data. And I imagine it's all, you know, virtual machines and lots of stuff that is not necessarily, you know, super important to look at. You don't know until you've been to look at it. And I know a few forensics people involved in this kind of work. And it's a really long process, even normally, let alone doing it, you know, on 30 terabytes of hackerwares and, you know, kind of chat logs and screen grabs of whatever else. So, yeah, that must be that's a busy day at the office.
Now, someone has taken the dreamed up words of Bloomberg and turned them into reality. This is really cool. This is a story written by Andy Greenberg over at Wired. And, you know, the headline says, planting tiny spy chips in hardware can cost as little as $200. And someone has kind of, you know, done the hardware backdoor that was theorized in that Bloomberg piece.
Yeah, we've seen a couple of efforts to kind of recreate the grain of rice, you know, backdoor of, you know, through different approaches. And it's, you know, it's a funny case of, you know, sort of fiction being made fact by having written the fiction, you know, sort of the way things come true from science fiction. Yeah, we saw a while ago, I think it was Tramiel Hudson re-implemented the sort of exactly what was described in the Bloomberg piece, the kind of thing where you'd stick it on the baseball management controller's bus and Trojan its firmware during load. This particular demonstration of the similar sort of thing is a slightly different approach. This is a guy who got a chip that's being stuck on the serial line of a Cisco firewall that then during boot up injects commands over the serial port to then go password reset it, reconfigure it to allow you remote access, which is, you know, quite a different approach to doing it to the BMC on a, you know, general purpose computer. But once again, really smart way of doing it. And, you know, a very, very small chip, you know, on a very, very small chip on a large Cisco circuit board, really easy to do. I mean, you know, it's a good example of what hobbyists can do. And the fact that this kind of supply chain attack is, you know, is absolutely feasible, which we knew. And the thing that was that the Bloomberg story was really about was the fact that it was being actually done at scale in the wild, which turns out it wasn't, it seems, which, you know, rather than the fact that it wasn't possible. But it's always good to see people making these things real, you know, from that story.
Yeah, that's I 100% agree. Now, Microsoft taking some steps here to look at better integrity checking on PC firmware, I think would be a good way to describe this.
Yeah, it seems that Microsoft's research people have been thinking about what they can do with the classic PC architecture and the sort of the ecosystem around it, you know, where you've got, you know, vendors like Microsoft and vendors like Intel and the motherboard vendors, and then a whole bunch of OEM manufacturers that actually build equipment and then run Microsoft software, and thinking about how you do software assurance in the way that, say, Apple does with their much more integrated, you know, set of products, or Google does, you know, with Pixel phones, Android phones, where they control the whole stack. Trying to think about what that means, what that looks like in a PC-style ecosystem. So Microsoft have been doing a bunch of work on a platform that kind of changes the relationship between the OEM hardware vendors and the device vendors that provide firmware, and how all of that gets validated during boot up, and you know, moving towards more of an approach that's similar to the way that Apple does it, except while still maintaining the ability to run, you know, Windows on a more open platform, which is, you know, makes sense for Microsoft to be leading that kind of work, because in the end, it's their platform, even though it's built by other people. And so, yeah, I mean, it's all very early kind of research stage yet.
But it looks like, I mean, the main thrust of this is they want to move the integrity checking into the actual processor.
Yeah, that makes sense, right? To kind of trust route it right down in the chipset on the mainboard, and then to have much more control over how and when firmware is loaded and validated, so you don't end up with, you know, network drivers or drivers for, you know, hardware, drivers for like disk controllers and stuff, being in a position to circumvent the system, or, you know, having to rely on, you know, vendors like the Realtek, for example, we're going to talk about it a bit later on, you know, to write good software when clearly they don't.
Yes, that is right. Someone got a little bit fed up with a ransomware crew, went and owned their C2, stole all their keys, and released a decryption tool. We like it when this happens.
It's pretty funny stuff. Yeah, this guy got his NAS, the QNAP NAS device, ransomwared by this particular piece of ransomware that was doing the rounds, owned up their C2, stole the creds, dropped it all on Twitter, and then has been kind of tweeting at people saying, hey, you know, when they go, oh my God, I got my device ransomware, tweeting at them with like, here's the keys. Which on one hand, great public service, good guy, very funny. On the other hand, like, I really hope this is, you know, a super amateur ransomware operation that's not run by real criminals, because, you know, rubbing their nose in the fact that you own them, you know, with your real name and stuff, you know, might be a problem otherwise. I don't know that I would do that.
Yeah.
But, you know, hopefully nothing bad happens.
Yeah, true. Oh, here's an interesting little piece here. EA is apparently giving users a free month of Origin access if they enable two-factor authentication. The reason I find this interesting is, you know, you've got a consumer-facing organization here actually putting a price on that enrollment.
Yeah, and it's, you know, it's kind of nice to see EA doing something not terrible for once. So that's really refreshing, perhaps. But yeah, I mean, obviously they have a whole bunch of costs associated with having accounts stolen, and it, you know, maybe it is actually cheaper for them to give people a month of access and have them turn on 2FA. So yeah, honestly, a good move, and I think other people should follow suit.
We got some bugs affecting Pixel, Samsung, Huawei, and Xiaomi devices.
Yeah, this was another local privesque that was being identified by Google's tag team. Sounds like another NSO group, local privesque bug that's been burnt in the wild. Seems to be a bunch of those doing the rounds lately. Good work, Google, for catching and killing a few more. I don't think anyone's surprised by, sandbox escapes and local privesques on Android. Maybe patch all your devices, try not to install apps from garbage places, and avoid NSO customers.
Yeah. Just one thing I'll quickly mention is Washington Post just appointed a contributor who, as it turns out, is also an advisor to NSO, which, you know, is implicated in the murder of one of their columnists, and it's all just crazy. So but yeah, the mind, it boggles, as we would say. There's an interesting piece here from CyberScoop written by Jeff Stone, and it's looking into how cyber insurers are actually incentivizing their clients to select specific vendors. Now, this is the sort of thing that, if they get it right, could have a massively positive impact. What do you think?
Insurance companies do have a really interesting role here, right? Because, I mean, they have a genuine financial incentive to actually do things that work. And, you know, there's a lot of garbage vendors out there having things where insurers have looked at how breaches happened, where there were products in play, what they did, and then make some recommendations based on that. Like, that does seem like, you know, evidence-based decision-making in InfoSec is not a thing we do very often, so any excuse to do that seems amazing to me. On the other hand, the financial incentives to kind of game this and you know, use it as a marketing tool and all that kind of thing really gives me the heebie-jeebies. That's a polite way of saying it.
Yes.
So I'm a little mixed. I mean, what I would, I mean, I think give it another few years, once we've seen a whole bunch more breaches, we'll end up with these insurance companies having to arrive at, you know, actually it's not about products, it's about doing a bunch of things right. And they'll end up with, you know, pushing really good guidance rather than necessarily products. And we have to go through the product phase and the squeaky marketing phase to get there. And so
it can be about products, like using Duo, I would think, would getting a discount on your premium to roll Duo everywhere would be a good thing. You know, alternatively using, you know, just any two-factor thing, or, you know, rolling out some of these SSO plays or whatever, like, or use Proofpoint for your mail, right? Like, I can see that those specific recommendations where the products are of a good standard, of a high quality standard, it does make a difference.
It does, and it would be good to have it. You know, here's a list of products that do these things, but it's going to end up coming back to the actual concepts, right? I mean, that it is two-factor on all of your externally accessible everything, or that it is, you know, good quality EDR or whatever that product happens to be. And some recommendations for specific products would be really good, but in the end, it is about, you know, more design and concept and, you know, architectural things, and that's where it will end up getting to. I mean, none of the things on the ASD top 4 or top 11, top 10, whatever, however many there are these days, you know, none of those are about product. And that's a really good set of recommendations. And I would rather an insurer said, go do what the ASD says instead of, you know, buy a product.
Well, sure. But I mean, some things on that list are supported by product, like whitelisting, for example.
Sure, sure.
Right? Yeah. Like, which is kind of impossible to do with, not impossible, but very difficult to do with native Windows. But there are third-party vendors who allow that. So I don't know. You know, this is me being typically trying to be glass half full and you trying to be glass half empty. So you're right, though. It's going to take a few years and we have to see where it lands. But I think an initiative like that has promise. So it's called the Cyber Catalyst Program. So much cyber these days, my God. Cyber Command ran a bug bounty and apparently squeezed out 30 vulns across the Department of Defense.
Yeah, the story sounds really good right up until the end. So the story, the bit that's good is they did a bunch of bug bounty stuff. They got some bugs fixed. Apparently there was some high and critical vulnerabilities identified. Blah, blah, blah. That's all great. Until you get down to the bottom where it says how much money they paid out for this, which was a total of $30,000.
Yes. Like, really, $33,750. Woo!
Like, that's how much you're willing to pay out. Like, you're telling me there's only $30,000 worth of bugs in
the better US watch out, like, Department of Defense. These people are going to unionize in California and then you're all boned. You're finished. Look. Good news story here from CyberScoop. Looks like the US Commerce Department is starting to make life difficult for Chinese companies implicated in surveillance, even within China, which is interesting.
Yeah, this is a nice development to see. I mean, there's not very much good news about, you know, sort of the surveillance and oppression in China and, you know, the fact that there's some economic pressure being brought to bear on some of the vendors that provide equipment, you know, cameras and biometrics and all sorts of other, you know, information wrangling that is being used by the Chinese government to oppress its own citizens. It's good to see that kind of being called out and punished a little bit in the, you know, international geopolitical sphere. But it's also such a small part of the larger, you know, sort of geopolitics and economic relationship between the, you know, between China and the West, that it's, you know, really kind of small fry. But it's a nice, you know, it's nice to see something because the news is so depressing otherwise. So yeah, a little bit of good news.
Yeah, I'm going to link through to a Haaretz piece about the situation in Xinjiang. Did you read that one? Did you?
Yeah, it's so miserable.
It is brutal reading. It is absolutely brutal reading. You know,
if you don't have spoons, listeners, don't read it. It's really miserable.
It is really miserable. You know, we're talking. I mean, this is just directly comparable to what the Nazis did.
Yeah, it absolutely is, yeah. And it's just ridiculous that it's happening. You know, in 2019 AD in our world. You know.
But yeah, I'll link through to that, and people who are feeling brave enough have a read of that, because it's shocking. I should have put this story with the other ransomware one, but a shipping technology giant, Pitney Bowes, that has been ransomwared as well. So yeah, there's still plenty going around at the moment. Turning our attention to Forbes. Forbes is reporting that North Korea is using fake cryptocurrency companies to break into Mac OS. Like, what's this one about?
So this is the North Koreans obviously need more cryptocurrency to pay for their economy, and they've been making like fake cryptocurrency tools like wallets and currencies and stuff, dropping them on GitHub and then with Trojans in them, obviously, and then linking them around to the sorts of people who work at cryptocurrency exchanges and things, saying, hey, go check out our new cryptocurrency, give it a hoon, and then you end up getting getting a Mac owned in this case, because everyone who runs crypto exchanges clearly use Macs, then North Koreans can break into your exchange, steal your Bitcoin and get on with life. Yeah, nice targeted attack. I'm sure it's gotten them a few coins. Be aware of new cryptocurrency wallets on GitHub, I guess.
You know, it's funny, right? Because regular listeners would have heard me mention the case of the Pong Su. This was a drug ship that came from North Korea. So it was like a North Korean heroin smuggling operation that fell to pieces in Australia, where this ship just turned up off the coast of Victoria, in the sort of southeastern part of Australia. And, you know, one of the people actually died trying to row the drugs to shore, and then the AFP were already watching the whole operation. There was a bunch of arrests and whatever. An Age journalist has actually turned that into a podcast, and I think they're up to like episode 2 or 3, but it's called The Last Voyage of the Pong Su, if anyone's interested, because it is something that I've mentioned on the show before. You know, they really flesh out that story, so people can go and search for that. The Last Voyage of the Pong Su. Uzbekistan, they're state-backed hackers, Adam, not so crash hot.
Yeah, there's been a bunch of reporting about Kaspersky's investigation into the Sandcat crew, which is, the Uzbekistan security services. They have not great OPSEC, it seems. They've been owning up all sorts of stuff all around the place, burning zero day like it goes out of fashion. They've made a bunch of fairly newbie mistakes, and the Kaspersky researchers that have been monitoring them have been having a jolly laugh at the expense of the Uzbekistanis. Things like running the Kaspersky AV on their dev boxes and then, like, shipping, you know, early builds of their malware off up into Kaspersky, or indeed when they get deliveries of new zero day from NSO Group, like taking the USB stick that it arrives on, like sticking it in their Kaspersky AV machine, which then goes, hey, look, here's some new SAS looking files, I'll ship them off to the cloud, and Kaspersky, you know, gets the bugs before the Uzbekistanis have even used them yet.
That's a good way to burn your relationship with your friendly NSO rep.
that's part of the story arc, because it does look like at some point whoever was selling the bugs was getting sick of them getting burned all over the place, because they were burning the O-Day, and then Kaspersky were going and looking to see who else was using it, and then finding all of the other customers, because obviously the Uzbekis were a bit too cheap to go buy the exclusive access, and they were, you know, buying stuff that had been sold to the, you know, the UAE and whoever else around the Middle East, and so they was burning a bunch of other customer operations.
They were certainly in the bronze tier.
Exactly. And then they started developing their own tooling as a result of, you know, not being able to buy other people's stuff. And then one of the docs, like they were testing some like Word doc delivery system, and the guy, one of the developers, put a screenshot of his desktop in the Word doc just, you know, for a test image. And then Kaspersky nicked that. And it had like, you know, all of his developer notes about the new, you know, cybering tool they were developing. So yeah, Kaspersky having a jolly laugh at their expense. And I imagine there's some, you know, slaps on the wrist at the National Security Service in Uzbekistan for having such terrible trash level OPSEC.
Yes, yeah, that's funny. Moving on, and Intel is proposing a new type of CPU memory that it hopes will basically mitigate these speculative execution side channels.
Yeah, so this is a research project to kind of come up with some generic defenses to allow Intel to continue to use speculative execution for performance gains whilst mitigating the ways that it can be used to leak information into kind of other users of the speculative, other speculative branches or things going on. So I mean, a way to generically kind of address these problems. And the research prototype they've come up with is something, it's kind of like having serialized memory. So serial, where the operations that access local memory on the CPU are serialized in a way that they're kind of bound to the speculative execution path. That was my reading of the, like, it was kind of dense, and you know they haven't got any working examples yet. So I don't understand this stuff.
You may as well be speaking Greek, man. I got no idea.
Anyway, Intel do smart thing. Try to come up with smart idea. It not smart yet, but maybe one day.
Okay, good. Nice TLDR. That's pitched at about my level of comprehension there. I do appreciate that. Earlier on in the news, Adam, you mentioned that we were going to talk about Realtek and, Realtek drivers. And, no real surprises here. There is a Realtek driver with a bug in it, which is a pretty bad one. Very typical sort of problem that we see with these types of drivers.
Yeah, this was a great bug dug up by Nico Weissman.
Really?
Previously of Immunity, now actually at GitHub, doing a bunch of research. He's got a bunch of cool tools for finding interesting bugs. He found a memory corruption bug in the Realtek drivers that you can kind of trigger over the radio, corrupt memory, and he hasn't got a working exploit yet, but I mean, it's Nico, he'll get there. Anything where you can kind of do kernel memory driver memory corruption over the air without any other prerequisites, like just being on the local RF channel, those are pretty cool bugs. Everyone wants those, so definitely keep an eye on this one. It's been in the driver for many years, it seems, perhaps someone's got a working bug. But yeah, just a good reminder that kernel drivers are a great place to go hunting.
Yeah, so that's affecting the driver on Linux systems. So fun stuff. Okay, so here's our skateboarding dog of the week, Adam. We've had two really quite funny bugs in the phone unlocking biometrics from both Google and Samsung. The Samsung one is my favorite because it turned out that any thumbprint would unlock their thumbprint scanner, which is like, you just sort of wonder how on earth?
And I mean, you can imagine the requirement spec says, phone must unlock when you put a thumb on it. So now they build a thumb detector and, job done.
Thumb detector.
What was it? Google's one, there was some issue with their face recognition where it was supposed to be able to tell that you were, had your eyes open and were awake and stuff. And you could just like hold the phone in front of the sleeping person and then it would unlock. So Google is adding more liveness detection. But I think both of these stories illustrate that, from a consumer perspective, when you get a device that works, right, unlocks and you put your thumb on it, or when you look at it or whatever, it's very hard to tell as a consumer with consumer level sort of experience whether or not it actually works, as opposed to is just
appears
garbage
to work. Yeah,
whereas Apple's one, clearly they did a whole bunch of work and like the Face ID stuff works surprisingly well, and same with them. I mean, we haven't really seen any significant issues with their old Touch ID biometrics as well, so it kind of, you have to kind of take it on faith from the vendor that, some vendors do this work to a high standard and some, like Samsung, a little more, garbage, just put a hot dog on the phone and unlock it kind of thing. So it's just, it's hard to tell, and security quality is opaque, and this is a good example of that.
Yeah, it is. Now, before we go, I just want to mention that Jim Baker, the former general counsel of the FBI, has written a very long piece for Lawfare called Rethinking Encryption, in which he says, let's embrace reality here. It's not going to happen. Backdoors are bad. Okay, bye. And it is a really interesting read. And he makes some very compelling arguments that law enforcement and governments should just quit pursuing this idea of being able to unlock devices and peek inside people's conversations. And, it is just, that's reality now. Time to deal with it. Have a read of it, everyone, because I think it's a really interesting piece. And of course, you can go back. I interviewed Mr. Baker on the program a few months back, and that was a good chat as well. So that's just a reading list item for you all this week. But Adam, that is it for the week's news, or the news of the last few weeks. Thanks a lot for joining us. And you're actually not with us for the next couple of weeks. Alex Stamos is filling in for you next week, and the week after that is Pipes, because you are actually going to have a real holiday.
Yeah, I'm going to go away and not look at computers for a couple of weeks at least, maybe look at some trees, not think about the internet. It's going to be amazing. I'm sure Alex and Pipes will take care of all the terrible things.
Yeah, and just have a great time, mate, because I know how hard you work. And I suspect the break will do you some good, mate. So have a great time, you and yours, and we'll chat to you in a few weeks.
Yeah, cheers very much, Pat. I'll talk to you then.
That was Adam Boileau there with a look at the week's security news headlines. Big thanks to him for that. Okay, next up, we're going to hear from Stefan Edwards, the practice manager of assurance at this week's sponsor, Trail of Bits. Trail of Bits is a security engineering firm based in the United States, and they do all sorts of interesting work. Recently, Trail of Bits was commissioned along with, I think, Atreides Partners to do a security audit of Kubernetes. In the end, Trail of Bits contributed something like 200 pages to the final report, and the TLDR, according to Stefan, is Kubernetes is basically pretty good, but it can be complicated to run, so a hosted version is going to work best for most people. Here's what Stefan had to say.
So the whole point was basically to deliver three things. We were looking for a threat model of Kubernetes itself, a white paper on the ergonomics of Kubernetes, and then a technical review of like any of the sort of things that you would see in a code review of Kubernetes.
What do you mean by ergonomics? Sorry, I've not heard that term used in this way before, right?
So security, ergonomics, usability, those sorts of things. Basically, the usability, the user experience of using Kubernetes and actually running things and configuring Kubernetes, whatnot. So basically, what they were looking for was not just the sorts of like security vulnerabilities and threats and things like that, but they were actually looking for what did we find difficult to use in Kubernetes? What did we find difficult to configure? How the hell did we run this thing?
You know? That makes a lot of sense, right? Like, I've never heard the term before, but it's like, can you safely use this? I suppose in like an automotive context, mm-hmm. Ergonomics is about whether or not the switches are in the right place. And that's probably something you want to factor in to something like Kubernetes, which is being used by a lot of people who aren't necessarily security specialists. So yeah, makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And it's difficult, right? Kubernetes is huge. There's lots of knobs. There's all sorts of stuff going on there. So
yeah,
we want to make sure it's as easy as possible to do.
Now, it seemed like, Kubernetes went from being sort of this obscure little bit of useful software to being, everywhere very, very quickly. And usually what happens when something like that occurs is after a while, people take a look at it and we start seeing some horror show bugs. And indeed, we have seen some pretty bad bugs being disclosed in Kubernetes. Mm-hmm. I imagine that was one of the reasons that the Linux Foundation wanted to commission this audit. Is that right?
So they were looking for a few different things to come out of it. They were looking for most of the low-hanging fruit to come out. They were looking for new things rather than reporting on the old things there. And they were looking to see if we could really shake out the sorts of obvious bugs that maybe wouldn't be found in like a pen test or something of that nature. So like a lot of our integer parsing bugs in the report itself, we can talk about that later. A lot of those are not something that you would necessarily see during a penetration test, or you wouldn't see whilst moving laterally through Kubernetes itself. So
it's more like a detailed teardown on Kubernetes itself rather than, what you're going to see as a tester moving through an environment.
Right, exactly. No lateral. We did do some lateral movement, but that wasn't the main focus of what we were looking for.
Yeah. So tell me, what did you find? Right. Like that's the interesting part.
Right. I mean, we found, I wrote a ton on this, but we basically found 17 design related issues. We found, I believe, 37 technical issues, and all told, it's like almost 200 pages worth of reporting here, from Trail of Bits side. I think total between us and our partners, it was like 250 pages worth of reports.
Now, so I mean, obviously we don't have time to go through a 250 page report, but I mean, usually with a report like this, right, there's going to be some issues, maybe some mem corruption issues, maybe some logic bugs, whatever, right? You patch them, you fix them, you move on. So, can you describe to me the general findings of the report? I mean, you're always going to have this situation where, okay, there's specific things that need to be fixed, right? And that all gets submitted and works its way through the open source sausage factory, and those things will get fixed. But, what was the general finding about the state of Kubernetes, given that it's become such a critical piece of software? Was it, how did it come up?
I mean, despite having 37 findings, technical findings and 17 design related findings, there was nothing really truly critical that came out of it. There was no complete bypass of RBAC or something of that nature. There was a few highs. Most of them had to do with things like not using TLS by default, something that you've probably seen if you've run Kubernetes itself before. In general, there's a lot of small medium issues that are problematic, right, for the correctness of running Kubernetes. Like there was just dumb stuff. Like you can set a port that overflows and then bypasses some controls there, right? Because integers were just not parsed properly. Just silly things like that that would happen. You can out of memory kubelet and other components and things like that. But there was nothing of the sort of criticality of the sorts of like really scary, this is news catching headline, everyone should fix this right away. I think it's the more correctness issues, the sort of steady things that projects should be doing as they get more mature.
Well, I mean, this it absolutely does, but this is reassuring because it's unusual for a piece of software that accidentally becomes the next hot thing to survive an audit and with the auditors to come away and say, well, it's generally fit for purpose, which seems to be what you're saying here.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the thing is that with who's backing Kubernetes, it's not like this was a ragtag group of people, right? Like when I was doing the threat modeling, I was talking with people from Red Hat, from Google, from Salesforce. These are the sorts of large companies that are, you know, like knee deep into Kubernetes and really trying to fix things there. So it's open source and it's up and coming, so to speak. But the people behind it, you know, they really know what they're doing and they're really trying to fix a lot of these sort of things, you know? So it was interesting. It was definitely an interesting space to work in.
Let's just roll it back a second and talk about some of the design issues, right? Because they generally are pretty interesting. And you mentioned this whole idea, the concept of, you know, security ergonomics. Were those design issues around that you've found around that ergonomics thing or are you talking about different stuff?
So we had an ergonomics report, which is like a white paper, basically all the things we found whilst like trying to configure Kubernetes, fighting with things, trying to make it like, you know, trying to make sure that it wasn't going to break the minute you actually configured it. There's some obvious things that the documentation points out that if you're not paying attention to said documentation, you can easily miss. So the ergonomics were around those sorts of things.
So whereas about maybe changing some of the defaults and things like that.
Exactly. So one of the things that we push back on is like, you should always use TLS by default. It just has to be that way. You shouldn't be in this the year of our Lord 2019 should not be falling back on like pure HTTP, you know, that sort of thing. So those came out of just like reading the documentation and noting that it's not the default. With what was, I think, more interesting with the threat model was that getting people from the open source milieu, asking people from the community to sit down and do a threat model and do a design review, and then hacking up whatever they said into notes. It's right in GitHub as well. So all of my notes from those meetings are there. Folks can go review them. But seeing those sorts of like, the sorts of things that people who know Kubernetes run it and work on it every single day, the sorts of problems that they see with Kubernetes, taking those notes and saying, oh, that's interesting. Let's talk about that a little bit more. So that's where the threat model was. It really just came out of me talking with people like Tim Alclair, who works on containers and works on kubelet quite a bit, and just taking those sorts of findings and those sorts of conversations and then writing up a bunch of crap about it. So it was pretty interesting.
Yeah, no, it sounds it. But I guess at this point, like it makes sense that we can kind of say, like I'm going off this interview now, we can say that Kubernetes mm-hmm. is doing okay, right? Like, and that's a great thing because we did see a few showstoppers over the last couple of years. I'm getting the sense that maybe they're the exceptions to the rule and perhaps we can consider Kubernetes to be reasonably robust.
I think the code itself is reasonably robust. I think the problem now with Kubernetes is going to be the sorts of things that not in our space, like what Trail of Bits does with sorts of correctness and things like that, although there are plenty of issues there. I think the things that you're going to see are the Ian Coldwaters and the Chris Gates and the Jay Beal style of lateral movement, like security misconfiguration, the OWASP 8, you know, 2017 A6 sort of stuff, where the defaults in Kubernetes allow lateral movement or they allow things like one of the findings we had was, you know, credentials are checked into every pod by default. So if you have access to a pod, now you have access to a set of credentials that you can try to move laterally, no matter what pod that is. So those sorts of like misconfigurations of defaults, those sorts of like insecure defaults are what we're where we're going to see the problems in Kubernetes remain for a while.
I totally get where you're coming from. And, you know, this interview is being recorded very soon after the last weekly show. So when this airs, it will have been 3 weeks. So it might be, you know, people will have forgotten about this. But, you know, we just covered that issue of ONAP accidentally enabling SSH agent forwarding, right? So like that, you know, that was just a case of a configuration issue that had disastrous consequences. And, you know, Kubernetes is only going to be as good as how you use it, if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think for most folks, if you're running Kubernetes in the cloud, you're probably fine. GKE read over the threat model and they read over the technical report and they issued a report that says, these are all the things that GKE solves that you don't have to think about if you're reading the Kubernetes assessment. I think the concern is going to be those folks who try to run it on their own rather than try to use the hosted solutions that come out there.
So you think it's a better way just to have it managed for you?
Yeah, I think so. I think Kubernetes is great for the sorts of like DevOps experience and things like that. I think Kubernetes is a lot to get yourself into if you're not going to fully dedicate it. It's not something that you can just like do part-time or have someone pick up. It's something like you kind of live and breathe for a while.
So unless you can afford a Kubernetes team, don't bother.
I wouldn't say don't bother. I would say probably you do hosted Kubernetes at least for a while.
Well, that's kind of what I meant.
Really understand the internal. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. It's sort of like running your own. I guess the obvious parallel here would be like running your own SMTP infrastructure or something, right? Like, is that something you want to do?
Yeah, right. Exactly. I mean, think about you know, when I started in InfoSec in like 2007, right? People would still try to run mail servers. They'd have problems all the time, things like that. Now you're using Office 365. You're using Gmail. Those sorts of things. You don't do it unless you absolutely need to run an SMTP server. And even then, it's kind of, you know, suspect. It's kind of a smell as to why you're doing it, you know?
So it sounds like there are pitfalls, there are dragons there, but the people who are really knowledgeable and competent with Kubernetes won't have too much trouble mitigating those issues.
Most of them, yeah. I think there's a few things that once they've solved those design issues as well, like Kubernetes itself will be in a much more robust place. The one that comes to mind is like, so you can define policies in Kubernetes, for example, like for pod security policy or for network policies, and then you can select components that don't enforce those policies. But Kubernetes will not tell you like, hey, this is a problem. You selected a CNI that does not enforce network policy. So you think, hey,
I've got this policy in place. Yeah, but
yeah, exactly. I have this great policy. It limits all of the network connections with everyone. And then, oops, like Chris Gate comes in and he like just moves laterally through your network because you have not filtered anything. Mm. So those sorts of design issues are obviously problematic, but they're not intractable. The folks who need to fix those things, they understand them and are working on those.
Well, and that's why, you know, all of these third-party vendors are going to come in with, you know, superseding policy managers and all that sort of stuff, right? Like that's what we tend to see.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think, you know, you're going to see the, like the sorts of sys benchmarks and those sorts of things. I'd really prefer if we can make the defaults of Kubernetes such that you don't need those sorts of external benchmarks, those sorts of external
tools. Well, that's the best case scenario, right?
Right, right. And I think the security team at the Linux Foundation and in the Kubernetes world, I think they understand that direction and they're not against it. They're not opposed to it. So that's always a healthy situation, you know? Mm. You know, it would be different if they wanted the sys benchmark in there for everything. Then I probably would have had a very bad time trying to do this report. But, you know, it worked out in the end. Everything seemed to be, everything seemed to be good.
All right. So. Well, Stefan Edwards, I'm going to link through in this week's show notes to a bunch of your work on the Kubernetes audit. That was a very interesting little look through it. I really appreciate your time. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Have a great day.
That was Stefan Edwards of Trail of Bits there talking about the work they did on the security audit of Kubernetes. Big thanks to him for that. And big thanks to Trail of Bits for its continued support of the Risky Business Podcast. And that is it for this week's show. I do hope you've enjoyed it. I'll be back next week with more security news and analysis. But until then, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.